Welcome back to the Untangling Web3 podcast. Today we have a very special episode for you indeed. We're joined by two remarkable guests, Evan McMullen and Diego Fernandez. Evan is a major player in the decentralized identity space, breaking new ground for metaverse-friendly identities with Disco, as well as being the co-founder of Privado ID, formerly Polygon ID. While Diego is leading an exciting and ambitious new project to bring government-issued digital identity to more than 3.6 million citizens in Buenos Aires with Quark ID. Today, we'll be discussing the need for digital identity at real scale and finding out how technologies like zero-knowledge proofs are finally helping this become a reality. Without further ado, welcome to the show, Evan and Diego.
Hi, Jack. How are you?
GM guys, it is wonderful to be here with you today. Thank you so much for having us.
No, thank you guys for being here. This is a super exciting episode, as I mentioned in the intro there. I think we've talked about digital ID on our show a couple of times in the past, but this is the first time we've had people, you know, talking to us about the real world experiences of bringing these systems to life. So yeah, really excited to hear about that, the kind of challenges and ways we can overcome those challenges are around bringing these scalable systems to light. Maybe just to kick things off, can you give us the very quick one, two sentence intro to who you guys are, what you guys do?
My name is Evan McMullen. I am the co-founder of Privado ID. I have been building in the blockchain identity space for now about a decade, spending time leading teams at places such as Consensus, as well as a project that I founded called Disco. At Privado ID, we make it easy to prove a trait about yourself, such as the fact that you're a person, you're in a specific location, or even that an address belongs to an AI agent. And then we make it easy to reuse that data across different applications and services. And so we'll get into what that means for better user experience, more personalized internet interactions, and faster and more stable infrastructure across the connected world.
Well, my name is Diego Fernandez. I'm the co-creator of Quark ID, which is a self-sovereign identity protocol, the likes of Privado ID. I'm the former Secretary of Innovation of the City of Buenos Aires. And this is where I started this identity journey something like four years ago. And I think the definition that Evan gave is accurate, is correct. I think that it's one of the most obvious areas of improvement that we have in the tech arena. I always quote the same thing, which is we're planning to send rockets to Mars and debating where artificial general intelligence is something that we'll achieve within the next 24 months. And it doesn't ring a bell that when we need to prove our identity, we start taking pictures of pieces of plastic and doing strange movements with a camera. It's kind of crazy. It's so outdated. So we need to improve and we have an immense opportunity over there.
I love that intro. I think, so we have talked previously about digital identity and Web3 identity systems. And like you've kind of touched on there, it's the most foundational piece. Like we live in this big data economy where data is everywhere, but you know, data doesn't have that much value unless I can tie it to an individual. It's like the data is an extension of myself and it's all linked to my identity. But we've always talked about it from like an academic perspective. These are the theoretical value propositions of these potential digital identity systems. So exciting to have two people that are actually making this happen in the real world. And Diego, you've just like started off there. You talked about your background in the politician sphere, and now you've gone into more of the tech world. Can you tell us what was the driving force behind this project? What were the core problems that you were aiming to solve there with Quark ID and Miba?
Well, in the case of the city of Buenos Aires, it's a completely digitalized government, or mostly digitalized. The thing is that you have two problems. Within the government, digitalization occurred in a very frantic pace and is mostly comprised of silos. So you have everything digitalized, but in a digital silo. Just to give an example, to take out or to renew your driver's license, you are asked for certain certifications. For example, I don't have parking tickets. For example, I have my car taxes up to date. Those certifications came from digital systems, but you were forced to go log into that systems, download the digitally signed PDF, and upload it into the driver's license system in order for you to go on. And there is friction, there is time, there is effort, which of course is not necessary. given that those documents are within the government infrastructure. So you have two chances of interoperating that reality. One is, okay, I'll do this backbone of interoperability that we deal with it in the back end, and we did that. We implemented the X-Road, which is a system that on a centralized basis, you're able to interact the information between two organizations, as for example, the parking tickets agency with the driver's license issue agency. The characteristic is that that type of operation has a very high frequency cadency. You're requesting that information on a constant basis. Hence, it makes sense to make a back office interaction. But how does this affect when you are dealing with organizations which doesn't have such a big cadence of interoperability? When maybe I request your certificate 2, 3, or 4 times a year. So it doesn't make sense to invest the effort in generating this type of backend of interoperability. The use case that we saw in the city of Buenos Aires is precisely that. Building and helping build this type of self-sovereign identity protocols allows within governments of the region, within governments of the world, and within private organizations, the ability of exchange provable data on a decentralized and permissionless manner. And that potentially opens a huge amount of value creation because of reducing that immense friction that we suffer every day. We live it in the infamous COVID time with the vaccination certificates, and we leave it every time that we need to exchange documentation with any given agency, either private or public.
I think that's a great example. Like, I think it really, people have been talking about Web3 and digital identity for a long time. Like Evan said, you've been in this space for a decade or something like this, right? But it was really like around COVID where most people started to see these systems really be implemented because they realized they needed something real time that could be deployed quite quickly, proven and verified very efficiently. And paper documentation was not the way to do that, right? A quick question for you, Diego. Like, so you worked in government. And I was in Buenos Aires recently. I was so impressed by the Bitcoin adoption there. Like everyone seemed to be, I saw Bitcoin signs everywhere. I was like, this is, you know, some futuristic in a way. And I understood that actually the reason was that was because of like hyperinflation, all this kind of stuff, which actually tailed off recently, which is a great thing. But how did you find out about the concept of Web3 as applied to these problems? Like, where did you first kind of come across this and how did you get that through? Because convincing, you know, non-technical people, politicians is sometimes tricky because these are quite ambitious projects, right?
Well, I mentioned this in a panel that I showed with Vitalik in last DevCon, which is, for me, crypto is a kind of better proposition for the rest of the world, which has, I mean, I don't know, logic economies. So Argentina has been in this economic nightmare for the last 70 years, and I will quote the number again. The other day came up a web page in which you put your date of birth and it gave you how much inflation you suffered during your lifetime in Argentina. In my case, I suffered 30% of inflation. Wow. And that's crazy. I mean, it's as crazy as it gets. So why did Argentinians embrace crypto and crypto ethos? Because for us, intermediates and governments dealing with our wealth, it's not something that maybe can corrupt. It's as bad as possible. I mean, we embrace crypto because you got your salary day one, and 30 days later, that salary was worth 25% less. So you need to do something about it. And crypto provided us with an immense opportunity for doing that. And it was just, it was an entrance door because the other day I was speaking with the founders of two of the most important wallets holding something like 12 million users in Argentina. And what they started to see, centralized wallets, was that the main asset being held by their users was stablecoins, something like 1 year ago, but it's Bitcoin today. So those users got in just to sort of protect against inflation. And then they kind of bought the crypto ethos and said, hey, you know what? I go into Bitcoin, I go into ETH. And for me, that's a pretty nice case of real world adoption. And how do you deal with politicians and so on accepting, because at the end of the day it was Secretary of Innovation, but the final decision is, hey, we will move forward with this project, is taken by a senior officer, in this case the mayor of the city, or the chief of staff. My point there is nobody buys technology, and decision makers don't understand it and honestly don't care about technology. They buy use cases, saying, hey, you know what? Yeah. We'll be able of, a policeman will show you a QR code and you'll be able of scanning it with an app, and that will allow the policeman to know instantly that that driver is entitled to drive. That's a fantastic use case. I love it. Hey, you know what? Private parties will be able of minting credentials in the same security as the government without paying no extra cost. Oh, I love that. Mm-hmm. Hey, you know what? Today in Argentina, kids that finish high school take almost 8 months to receiving their official high school title. Hence, that first year, they are incorporated in college on a temporary basis until they receive this their official incorporation. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. I lived that. I have two daughters who went through that process. Say, hey, you know what? This December, kids will be able of showing the digital verified credential of their high school degree. They won. And that is that from a politician's perspective, from the guy making decisions, say, hey, you know what? We'll be forward with that. Honestly, they don't need to understand, hey, this is sovereign and users should have the control and we're using blockchain technology in this or that way. What they will be making their decision on is, hey, this use case will provide society with a better experience, and then move forward with that. And you tech guy made that happen. I mean, that's your job, not mine.
No, exactly. I think it's a really interesting to hear you say that, you know, as a practitioner and someone who's been in government, right? And I can imagine, you know, as you said, in Buenos Aires, you probably have a population that's preconditioned to accepting the benefits of crypto and Web3 as an idea because of everything you said, right? Because of the inflation you've experienced, seeing, you know, Bitcoin and crypto for the monetary potential is, I guess, maybe an advantage you have to then looking at the second order use cases like things like digital identity, and that kind of makes it easier on the use case. But
not that much, again, not that much. Let me defer on that point, which is my thesis or my litmus test is, if a user knows it's using crypto, your product will fail. I mean, or it will be just used by crypto users. There's not that many of us. So in the case of digital identity in Buenos Aires, of course, users can go, tech users can go, they can download the core and the code of Quark ID from the GitHub and do their technical analysis, and that's completely fine. But I always put this example. We need an application that my 85-year-old mother, which time that she downloads an application in her iPhone, she calls me, say, hey, son, is this application safe? Yeah, mommy, it's in the App Store. Go and download it. No problem. No. So if you put my mother, 85-year-old mother, to sign transactions going back and forth from applications, she'll get lost from the moment one. She will be afraid of that. When you're dealing with deploying millions of users' use cases, you need to give them a Web2 experience with underlying Web3 technologies. But the experience needs to be extremely easy. They need to not realize that they're using Web3 technology.
Yeah, I think that I completely agree with as well. You know, making it easier to use is always, you can't be selling the Web3 and crypto as the thing. It's the use case, as you mentioned, that's important. Evan, I want to come to you on, again, maybe I don't know if it's a slightly different perspective, but someone, you know, coming from North America, I know you have an interesting background looking at information systems and maybe with an anthropological lens as well. But what was it that got you into digital identity and Web3? Like, what was your journey there? And, you know, what Diego's saying, does that resonate with why you're involved and what you're doing now? If you could give us kind of a bit more context on your path, that'd be really interesting.
Most certainly. I have had the good fortune of learning from leaders such as Diego for quite a while at this point. And actually very early on in my crypto career, had the opportunity to explain decentralized systems and the business benefits of utilizing networks such as Ethereum in the context of governments, working with groups from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, throughout the European Union, Asia, Africa, and beyond. So from this very global lens, it has been evident from the beginning that, you know, governments engage with use cases and the business outcomes that we can offer with more secure systems, more composable technology, and more, you know, more control while also enabling emergence, that these benefits have really been the driving force of all conversations where we see real outcomes. I think, you know, what brought me to the table specifically around identity is that the benefits of blockchains are limited when we do not have the ability to control for permissions that pertain to regulations. So having a permissionless offshore casino is one thing, but being able to coordinate more than treasury allocation alone requires identity, requires verifiable data. Some of the use cases that Diego has described in terms of improving citizen experience can also be transposed to our interactions with brands, our interactions with connected hardware, even things like our homes and our vehicles. One of the areas of development right now that is especially important as we talk about identity is AI. So, you know, we are currently positioned to not be able to tell the difference between synthetic and authentic without the types of tools we're here to talk about today. So you can think of Privado ID kind of like the Amazon distribution rails for your verifiable identity, making sure that the types of credentials or proofs that you receive from places like the city of Buenos Aires can travel with you to every corner of the connected world and can shortcut your ability to introduce yourself to new apps and services so that you can enjoy more of the personalized internet built around you based on data that can be discovered, that can be trusted. You also mentioned that, you know, we've been talking about these concepts for quite a while. In fact, in 1997, Professor Larry Lessig from Harvard first suggested that we might be oversharing to the bouncers at bars when we hand them our driver's license and let them know our eye color and whether or not we're organ donors, when all they need to know is whether we are of age to enter the establishment. I am pleased to say that based on the technology Privado ID and others have brought to market, that the concept of zero knowledge proof-based access control, or a quick scan and client-side validation to tell whether or not you are permitted to drive, to access the content, to release the capital, that is now all possible today in a safe and secure way. So we can enjoy these new technical capabilities in service of real outcomes, where we save time signing up for new applications, where we can feel safe and secure interacting with new services or even with our own governments.
I didn't know that little story, the anecdote about the oversharing to a bartender or a bouncer was from 1997. Wow, that is absolutely crazy that it's taken this long to actually, you know, start seeing these implemented in the real world. I also, we're definitely going to talk about the idea of identity and AI because it's one of my favorite topics. I think it's so interesting. But just to double click on a few things. So Diego said, you know, politicians, they don't care about tech, they care about use cases. But we're a tech podcast. We do care about the tech, and we've got you on, Evan. So we want to get your insight into, you know, can you explain at a high level, how does digital identity work? We've talked about, you know, the individual, we've talked about the bouncer, the verifiers, we've talked about government having a place there, and also the blockchain. But can you just give us a high level explanation of what the main components are and how they relate to one another?
So today, the internet is location based. What I mean by that is that when you go to visit a website, everybody generally sees the same version of that website. Now in Web3, with the introduction of blockchain keys and decentralized technologies, we can start to enjoy the identity-based internet, meaning that your address, the assets that you own, and the pieces of information about yourself that you've collected from others can also be used to inform your experience of different websites or different applications. What this means in general is that the cost of building trust with a new counterparty, or the amount of information about yourself that an app needs to collect in order to give you a great experience, that can be lower so that your, you know, entry into new spaces can be more effective. You can more easily discover the types of experiences that are relevant or interesting to you. When we think about how this actually gets expressed in different apps and different services from a technical perspective, one of the core principles of digital identity that can be really interesting and different here is that we can include the user. You as an individual can have a view of what your identity is and how it gets expressed. Whereas right now, your digital identity is mostly applications swapping secrets about you behind your back through a tangle of APIs. In the world of wallets, in the world of Web3, an identity can be self-sovereign, meaning that it can have more control over its data than any other party. This allows data to move with you from one app to another. Essentially, you can carry the data exhaust that you create and reuse it for different apps instead of having to, you know, start off a new application like it's your first day on the internet, fill out a bunch of forms, and then begin again for every next application that you experience. Sometimes, you know, folks might refer to this as rehypothecating data or reusing data. And, you know, at Privado ID, we think of ourselves as middleware infrastructure sitting between blockchains and apps, helping those apps reuse data, rehypothecate data, so that they can deliver better, more secure experiences faster.
Yeah, that's a really awesome description where I don't think you really even needed to talk about the blockchain, which is just a lovely change to how often we do. And we are going to get into that side of it. But I love the description of it as middleware, right? Because, you know, we actually spoke recently about Blue Sky on the show and how that is also using digital identity concepts to allow people to essentially not be locked into one social media platform, which I think is really interesting.
Today's episode is sponsored by the VeChain Foundation.
Now, we often talk about how emerging technologies like blockchain have the potential to revolutionize sustainability. And VeChain is at the forefront of this green movement with initiatives like VBetterDAO. Let's take a closer look.
Imagine tracking small actions like recycling at low cost, making them valuable assets. These verified records build a massive collective impact, benefiting people through their own actions. Sound a bit complex, but VeChain made it fun. Explore our apps at vbetter.com.
VeChain's goal is to power a new era of sustainable solutions. So if you've got an app idea or just want to earn rewards for small, sustainable actions every day, go check out vbetterdao.com to find out more. And now back to the show.
And it sounds like what you guys are doing at Privado is similar in a sense, but we haven't talked too much about the kind of nuts and bolts of the digital identity itself, right? And this is interesting because that concept has been around for a little while now. I know it's like a W3C standards type thing. You have people working on different implementations of the standard. And when you implement that standard, the standard is kind of agnostic to your platform, right? So if you're the middleware, what's the kind of base layer underneath that? Well, W3C doesn't really care about that. But what we do see time and time again is the base layer tends to be a blockchain, right? So we end up issuing these digital identities, these DIDs documents, they tend to interact with a blockchain. And I wanted to kind of ask you, Diego, about that aspect. So where does blockchain play a role in what you're doing with Quark ID? And, you know, because I'm pretty sure it is using blockchain. Why did you go down that route for having a blockchain-based digital identity solution when, you know, there are other options available? I'm curious to hear kind of what that thought process was.
It's a very good question. You can do digital identity and provide amazing use cases, and you can do it the good way or the bad way. So that is a shortcut that you shouldn't take. We have today several examples, and I won't mention them, but we have several examples of companies providing digital identity in a centralized manner, which is basically changing who controls thing. Because you know what? Now we're going to create this huge company, which is going to provide this really good use case, and you'll be able of utilizing your identity wherever you wish, but I'll be controlling all of the data. And that is such a risk. We're just changing things from one partner to the other. And we shouldn't pursue that alternative. And several governments are starting to use blockchain, but they use private permission blockchains. And this is a very personal take, but I mean, a private permission blockchain for me, it makes no sense. It's an oxymoron. Why would they need a private permission blockchain that I have, I don't know, Amazon S3 for that or Oracle databases or whatever? Why would I need a private permission blockchain. It doesn't make sense if I control all of the nodes. It's crazy. For me, the hard sell to my bosses at that time was, hey, we need to go with an open, non-permission blockchain. That doesn't mean that we won't be able of controlling, for example, if we accept or not a given driver's license. We should keep that control, but we should do that in an open, non-permission blockchain so as to create an ecosystem of value. And it's proven that when you do these private permission things, the ecosystem is not generated. If we open the doors, and we're seeing that in Buenos Aires with several private companies and individuals accepting and starting to leverage the use of Quark ID, we need to rely on open, non-permission blockchains. And that's what finally sets the thing apart. And I am extremely optimistic. I think that governments and big institutions are starting to see the value in using Ethereum as a security layer, in relying on a network which is decentralized and nobody will ever be able to manipulating. And for me, that's a road that we need, is starting, but we need to keep on, as Privado is doing, as Quark ID and is doing, we need to keep on promoting and educating decision makers on why this is the way to go and not falling on centralized providers or private permission blockchains.
That's really exciting to hear from someone who's in the space and actually deploying a real solution. And I think that's one of the things that excited me most about having you both on the show is this isn't just theoretical, it's not academic, you're actually doing it. And I actually want to know, so how is this being deployed right now? So this is an existing solution. We've talked hypothetically about, you know, the bouncers, me not needing to give all my credentials. Like whenever, you know, you see that classic diagram, whenever someone Googles what is digital identity, it's got the issuer, which in this case, I assume is the government. You've got the holder, which is the citizen, and you've got the verifier, which is the bouncer. And we've talked about the blockchain underpinning all of that data integrity. What is this doing right now? What are some of the use cases you're actually implementing? And what are some of the benefits that the citizens can actually see by using this? Because do you actually have police officers that have these apps that can scan it and prove credentials on the spot?
Today, the credentials, the driver's license credentials are being minted to the user's wallet. The verifier is not yet installed within the policeman's phones. That will be done in late December, probably. But today, if someone stops you in the city of Buenos Aires, if a policeman stops you, you're able of showing your credential, your driver's license credential, and that is accepted. In the next 20 to 40 days, we're giving policemen a general purpose verifier in order to check automatically on a cryptographic basis the ability of you to drive that given car. Without sharing, again, the type of information that it's needed, as I've been mentioned before. Bars in Buenos Aires in the upcoming month will be able of verifying any given user that is plus 18 years old without the need of that user of revealing their address, your blood type, I mean, even your date of birth, which is a totally unnecessary information just to give you a beer. The same thing with, as I mentioned before, college degrees. And, I don't know, private events, as for example, we had Aleph, which is a pop-up city in Buenos Aires, which was done in August with 3,000 plus participants. And they decided to use Quark ID to mint out the credentials, the Aleph passport, in order to get into the venue. And that is what I mean by ecosystem and leveraging an existing technology. Of course, governments, and I think that governments and big institutions have a huge role to play, which is doing a reverse bootstrapping. I mean, if government starts creating this user base for free and we pay as users, we pay the price as governments, we pay the price to making users going through that friction. Governments have this crazy thing, which is every government is a monopoly in their society. So if you need to create a driver's license, okay, you're a citizen of Buenos Aires, you have no other place to go. So you need to do it within the Buenos Aires government. So you can turn that monopoly again, working for the good reasons. So, hey, if you're a fintech company, it's so hard for you to say, okay, I'm going to put users through this friction because perhaps that gets your onboarding rate down 5% and you're not willing to pay for that. you need to be for the onboarding to be as fast and smooth as possible. But as a government, you can say, hey, you know what? We'll ask you to go through this biometric recognition thing once, and then all of the society can take the benefit of you doing that stuff. And mm-hmm. and I think that big institutions and governments have an amazing role to play over there.
Yeah, definitely. I think like that's kind of one of the misnomers about blockchain tech generally is that it is, you don't know who they are. It's anonymous. It's we're de-intermediizing everything. We don't need intermediaries anymore. We don't need governments and all this kind of stuff. And it's not true. I think you always need some point of trust to connect individuals, right? I think that will always exist. It's just how do we facilitate that trust in, say, a more efficient way? And governments still have a role to play there.
I think, honestly, Alec, in the future that we are trying to build with Evan and so many others in the industry, we will see this kind of web of attestations in which the government will be one important player, but Evan will perhaps attest that I am working in the identity industry for quite some time. I will do the same for Evan, and this mesh of trust will start being created, and we'll be able to attesting who we are, not only because I'm a citizen of Buenos Aires, but because I was part in this podcast and I am friends with Evan and she. That type of social reputation is a crucial part of who we are. And of course, if we live in a civilized and modern country, that's not an issue. But when you start to see this kind of regimes that try to constrain your liberties and so on, that social trust is crucial. And of course, all of us in this space have the fortune of having the possibilities of attending college, having credit banks and so on. But when you're dealing with subdued populations, this web of trust, of social trust, is perhaps the most valuable asset that they have. The thing is that today, they don't have the ability to prove that apart from the closed social circuits. This type of identity system will enable population to say, hey, you know what? I have been selling tacos in this precise location for the last 4 years, and I've been consistent paying my bills. Hence, I'm a subject of credit. And that today doesn't occur, and digital identity will start opening that amazing possibilities.
When we talk about digital identity systems and their opportunity for composability, how we can develop better experiences faster as a result of open ecosystems. This is really where the core of Privado ID comes from. Diego noted that you can build a sort of shortcut, centralized digital system that is monopolistic, where there is a single source of reputation and where there is perhaps a centralized server where every account is permissioned. These systems, of course, do not reflect reality, because if a centralized provider can delete your account, you do not cease to be a person. You are simply not accounted for in that particular database. And that is why it's important for a thriving and composable ecosystem that we embrace many different sources of reputation, proven authorities of expertise, whether social, professional, or institutional. That we enable composability across protocols, because no human being only uses a single protocol for their entire life. And as we've noted earlier as well, it's important for us to abstract away the complexity of that tech. We've been having a great conversation here today, and we haven't once mentioned TCP/IP or HTTPS. So making sure that we deliver outcomes based on the flow of how people already spend their time, and we do not align or trap ourselves in a silo of proprietary hardware, of a single protocol, or a single centralized service. So this open and composable ecosystem with an infinite number of reputation sources, an infinite number of types of credentials or types of reputation, an infinite number of protocols or devices where it can be compelled, where anyone can validate this data. That is what we have built in production today, currently available across chains in some corners of the EVM. And we are working with Diego and others to bring that capability and the associated data to every corner of the connected world.
I completely agree with what Evan said. Just to share my personal history, I started my first startup in 1998 and I was very young, and I sold companies, mails, and website. I love programming, so I program HTML websites. And I was forced to sell email because nobody was doing it in Argentina with a dial-up access. And by that time, if you wanted to deal with an email, everybody knew what a DNS MX record was, that the SMTP port was 25, POP3 port 110. You were forced to know that because, I mean, the tech was so complex and you needed to start doing a slash Q request in the DNS server to see if the MX record was correctly pointed. That was crazy. And email really took the world by storm when that type of complexity was only known by very specific set of people. And we're transitioning that phase precisely now. We need to give people an experience that is easy. And we need to do it with the correct values and the correct ethos. Today, if the CEO of Google decides to delete my Google account, hey man, I lost every digital asset that I own. I will need to sort of say, hey, please, please, please give it back to me because I will have lost access to every digital asset that I control. And that is not correct. We need to get out of that reality as soon as possible.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. And what we've just discussed, I think we have to highlight as one of the biggest advantages of the digital identity systems that you guys are building, those kind of open, extensible, composable systems, because to me, they perfectly mirror, you know, if you think philosophically about what is identity, I kind of subscribe to the view that it's like the sum of all the claims that are made about you, right? You shouldn't have a single person like a government that has a monopoly on who you are, who your identity is. It's about everyone in society and the claims they make about you, right? And what you identify with. So I love that idea of thinking of the government as just one claimant, someone who can put, you know, they can make some big claims about you, some strong claims that people will tend to believe. But then there's all these other types of identity that are so important, the social reputation that Diego mentioned, and, you know, everything from what your family and friends and peers think about you to your social media, all these things are related. And I love that, you know, from the sounds of it, you guys both have this very progressive view of this open system, right, where everything can come in, it's not monopolized. I think that's one of the key things I've kind of taken away from this. I would also just like to touch on quickly, you know, maybe an elephant in the room. We're talking about a really big project here in the Quark ID project in Buenos Aires. And, you know, 3.6 million people getting onto this kind of system is no small fry, right? But there will also be in the future, I'm sure, even bigger projects. And eventually, I think we want everyone in the world to be using digital identities. You know, like I said, Blue Sky is trying to onboard the whole world right now. So I want to ask you guys, how do we scale these kind of systems? What are the challenges of scaling them? And how can we address those? Maybe, you know, Evan, from the philosophical and theoretical side of things. And then Diego, obviously, you've been doing this in practice. So maybe if you could both offer your thoughts on this, that'd be great.
Usage turns specs into standards. You know, we cannot meme the entire world into a new system immediately all at once. And so that is why working with sources of reputation that have strong existing relationships and bringing them on board together in sequence, such as the way that Diego and the Quark ID team are working with different government organizations, such as the way that we at Privado ID work with different governments and institutions. It is that accrual of multiple parties in this open ecosystem working together over time and enjoying business benefits at every stop along the way. That is how we build these networks of value. And so I think this is a little bit different than some views of decentralized identity that are more focused on emergence as opposed to the intentional collaboration with regulators and with institutional bodies. I also see a unique opportunity in this market moment in crypto where the, you know, $2 to $4 trillion worth of institutional capital is sidelined because we cannot verify compliance on chain, mm-hmm. enabling the identity of institutions, the permissions of where their capital can flow to carry from one protocol to the next. So as we unlock this open composable ecosystem for governments to enjoy the network effects and, you know, benefits of composability on the trust that they provide, so too are we unlocking these benefits for institutional capital.
I completely agree with with what Kevin said. And in my experience, when you're dealing with government and government officials and you're selling the benefits of an open, decentralized self-sovereign identity protocol running on an open, non-permission blockchain, they say, okay, this is amazing, let's move forward. And then you move to the second desk and they say, hey, you know what, but let's do this private and permission. I say, no, why? Because they always fall in this kind of loop, hey, we want to control things. And speaking precisely about unlocking wealth, unlocking prosperity for society in the types that a real open, non-permission blockchain with a self-sovereign identity protocol may provide, that is the real battle. That is the battle that we need to give. And that is the and selling that idea is, for me, the most important part. All of the rest gets done. But we need to sell to decision makers this idea of, hey, the only way of creating real value is through open, non-permission blockchains running self-sovereign identity protocol with no any given party controlling the whole thing. And that is the thing. And honestly thinking, I think that we are lucky enough, I don't know if lucky is the word, but I mean, we have the privilege of being in this moment in time, because things are happening now. So for me, that's a privilege that we need to leverage as far as possible.
I'm glad you talked about like the network effect. Like, you're obviously seeing real value in your ecosystem right now, but there's going to be so much more value when you start to have people that are adopting this across jurisdictions, across borders, getting like a single identity where I can plug in, you know, all my applications, all my peer reviews, everything into one solid base. And again, I think one of the most important things here is when people think about that, they're like, okay, I don't want my business clientele seeing what I'm doing with my, you know, social interactions, what I'm spending my Bitcoin on. And like the ability to separate these down and, you know, selectively disclose what you want, when you want it, but it's all linked to one identity. It's quite a key principle of a lot of this stuff. And yeah, it's very exciting. Like, you've talked a little bit about some of the releases that are coming up. Like, I know you guys are both very busy, nose down, like getting the roadmaps out there. But if we take a step back, you know, we look outside of just like the next 6 months and to more of the future, and maybe even beyond like digital identity, I'd want to get your like, what are you most excited to see in the future of Web3 at large? Evan, I don't want to like push you in one direction, but you talked about digital identity plus AI. That's like a passion project of mine as well. So I kind of want to hear you talk about a little bit about that, but you choose. I want to hear from both of you and what you think the most things that excite you most about the general Web3 of the future is.
Obviously, we are heading into a season full of agents. I definitely think we can all agree most transactions on chain by this time next year will not occur as a result of click trading, but likely as a result of some programmatic or intent-based framework. I think that the unique pairing of blockchain keys, timestamps, and shared truths is very well suited to the generative capabilities of agents and all that we can unlock by wrapping for loops to get a little technical there, or, you know, bringing these more programmatically informed capabilities to the chain. As I mentioned earlier in our discussion, the ability to discern synthetic from authentic will be critical, not only in evaluating data itself and the various authorities from where that data comes, but also in terms of understanding how we improve AI agents, improve our models through further training and avoid model collapse. I think that the most straightforward, you know, logical way for us to do so is to take advantage of the key pairs we already have, the decentralized systems we already have in place, and to use a similar approach to how we think about identity for humans and institutions. That's why our team at Privado ID is leading the charge with different types of data for agent reputation. So, you know, you might have heard of KYC, Know Your Customer, and we are working with our partners to pioneer KYA, Know Your Agent, or ways that agents introduce or interact with one another. We're very hopeful that, you know, these capabilities will also give us a really straightforward way to interact with data that comes from government entities, that comes from known authorities in the real world, such as those that Diego and his team at Quark ID are bringing on board.
Oh, I love that answer. That is so exciting. I think when most people think of this stuff, they think of it's only about humans, right? We want to discern between humans and everything that's not human. But we also, there are a lot of agents and AI avatars that will add a lot of value and will want to have an identity system like you just talked about there that represents them as well. And like there will be a lot of good, you know, not just misinformation and pollution and garbage that comes from these actors as well. And they need to interact in the real world as well. In like 10, 15 years, they need to transact. There'll be AI, you know, to AI kind of comms and all this kind of stuff. It's a bit mind-blowing to think about how quickly this stuff is happening, but I think it's really at the forefront of, you know, the misinformation age where we need these identity systems for agents. That's really exciting to hear. Diego, I'd love to hear about, you know, insight into what the future holds.
I'm going to turn kind of more philosophical. I think that we happen to be born in this era in which the way that we govern ourselves will change. And that for me is a given. I'm not able of discerning, hey, we will govern ourselves in this way. And I think that the Ethereum ecosystem governing the evolution of its platform is a very good demonstration of how to deal with the governance of large scale projects in a different way as we govern large scale projects today. But let me push forward this rationale, which was first outlined by Tomás Puello in a very good article, which I recommend reading, which is each time that we change the way that we share information and trust in a society, the institutions that govern that society change. So the way of transferring trust and information was the oral language. Our institutional order was tribes. When writing appeared, then those controlling that technology, the church and the noblemen's, the feudalism, appeared as a way of governing ourselves. And that lasted until a new technology disrupted that way of trusting and sharing information, which was the printing press. And then the nation states got born. But if we analyze how we govern ourselves as a society today, it doesn't make real sense in the digital world. Why are we voting for people which go to the Congress or whatever and make decisions for us in 4 years? It's kind of crazy. I mean, that made sense when I elected Evin, and Evin traveled 4 months to go to the decision-making place, and then she represented the interest of all of us for a certain given time. But today we're voting online any given minute. We like or dislike a video, we choose to visit or not that website. So the way that we are governing society today doesn't make sense with the way that, with the means that technology provides and the way that society lives. And I think that Web3 and the blockchain trust combined with the internet as a massive universal communication layer, and now Web3 being able of transferring value, identity, assets in a completely secure manner, will definitely have an impact in the upcoming years. I don't know if that's 5, 10, 20, but I am positive that if I ever have a grandchild, that grandchild will live in a society which is governed by institutions working in a completely different manner and probably in a different set of institutions which will be created as an evolution of the nation state, which I don't know what that is, but I think that is happening.
Yeah, that's a really, really nice note, I think, for us to end the episode on. I think you're absolutely right. It seems like we have this flashpoint of new technologies or advancements in old technologies that are coming through Web3 and other areas, you know, AI and even other kind of security primitives that are coming out separately. It feels like we have a bigger and better toolbox than ever to solve some of the challenges we have around governance, right? And how we govern ourselves as citizens of countries. I think it's obviously a huge problem, and I don't think anyone has full solutions yet, but you know, even what we talked about in digital identity clearly has applications potentially in voting systems. The blockchain clearly has potential in improving transparency of funds, right? And issuing money potentially. There's so many things that we can get into. And I think, you know, without going down the rabbit hole, that's a really nice way to just kind of preview the world that we might be seeing in the future. And yeah, I really hope this won't be the last time we speak to you, Diego and Evan. I've learned a lot. I've really enjoyed hearing from some proper experts in this space about real things that are going on. So yeah, we hope maybe we'll talk to you again in the future about all those exciting things. But thank you so much for joining us. And to all those listening at home, thank you for joining us again this week. You can catch us next time to untangle a little more Web3.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.